Hello and welcome to episode 40 of Prog Notes. My name is Destin.
And I'm Drew.
And today we are listening to Ocean by Eloy. If this is your first time listening to our show, welcome. We try to educate and inspire our listeners to uncover and learn about progressive rock music. And we're very honored that you're with us. We would love to connect with you. So please give us a follow on Instagram or Facebook. Or you can join our Discord chat server to talk with Drew and I, as well as many other fans of the show and prog rock. These links are all in this episode's description. And we always want to say thank you to all of our patrons for helping this show and these episodes happen. You can become a patron at patreon.com/prognotes. Ocean is the sixth studio album by the German progressive rock band Eloy, released in December of 1977. For reference, this is just 2 months after A Farewell to Kings by Rush was released. Other albums also released in 1977 include Animals by Pink Floyd, which we featured on episode 27 of Prog Notes, so go check that out. Eloy was founded by the guitarist Frank Bornemann in 1969. The name Eloy is based on a futurist race of humans from the book The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. Bornemann describes the origin of the name of the band, as I quote here. Wells describes in his book the situation of mankind about 800,000 years later, and Eloy is the human race in his story. The Eloy and Wells story made a new start with the help of the time traveler. In a way, it was a new beginning for the human race. German rock bands in the 1960s played mainly covers from other bands instead of playing their own compositions. Record deals for German bands were absolutely rare, and German bands were generally considered to be second-class bands in their own country. At that time, it was a strong effort for a German band to come out with only their own compositions. It was a start into an unknown future, and this point of view is comparable to the human race in Wells' story. That is why I got the idea to name the band Eloy. And I just wanted to pause here because I already have to applaud them and applaud the band for being bold enough to go out and, if what he says here is true, to go out and write their own compositions and going after a record deal, even though they knew it was rare for German bands to do right. So. And I like how the name of the band relates to a quote, a new beginning. I kind of thought that was worth mentioning. So
it's really neat.
Yeah. And so now when people mention German and prog rock, you might be thinking of the idea of krautrock in your mind. But Eloy's musical style has a lot more in common with English progressive rock, in my opinion. And Drew, I know you had a couple of thoughts on this subject, right?
Yeah, we had discussed it the other day. They had more of a UK feel to them, but they still incorporated kind of the German essence of like what I call it, that sense of wandering or lingering we explored on our episode with Can.
Yeah.
And that was their album Future Days by Can.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out, that episode out. That one just kind of had this really kind of groovy feel that kind of went on for a while, and it was supposed to put you more in a mood than it was kind of a more focused effort that you kind of hear in a lot of progressive rock. And yes, progressive rock has long songs and they do have solo parts as well that can go on for a little bit, but it generally seems more focused. The krautrock that I've heard by stuff like Can and Neu, and you know, stuff like Tangerine Dream and everything too, you start to get more electronic and everything. It's very much, let's put you in this kind of mood for a little bit, and we're going to jam on it for a while. Kind of jam bandy in a way. Eloy is a little bit different. They retain that to a degree. You can hear that with even in this record with Ocean. But it does tend to sound more focused, more conceptual, with some of the other bands that they seem to be emulating, specifically Pink Floyd, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But they also seem to have a more focused concept. Like, this was clearly a concept album, and we'll get into that later.
Yeah, that was also another thing too. I think with the some of the krautrock is a lot of it was instrumental. And this has the inclusion of lyrics, and more than just lyrics, because Can also included lyrics, but some of their lyrics are just kind of like, huh? But this is very
a lot of them.
but this is very clearly a concept, very clearly a focused effort to create some sort of space or story for the lyrics to sit
it's
in.
It's kind of an interesting blend because, like I said, you can kind of hear, you know, the German influence of a lot of the other bands around that time, what they were doing. But again, like you said, Destin, definitely feel like it's more, they were more influenced by a lot of the UK prog pioneers.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And just to kind of expand upon that a little bit, their history was not dissimilar to Rush's as far as their sound. So when they were starting out, I listened to some of their early records, and man, it's pretty much hard rock.
Right.
Like early rock, early hard rock. So after Rock and Roll with Elvis and Little Richard and all that stuff, stuff like Led Zeppelin and Cream and The Who and Deep Purple, Jimi Hendrix, a lot of this kind of like blues-based, you know that sound. I mean, if you've heard it, you've heard it. Like these really classic hard rock icons, right? Yep. AC/DC, all that kind of stuff. They kind of had like just a very standard rock sound to begin with. And then they started to expand more into stuff that was really psychedelic. And again, Pink Floyd kind of comes to mind. Like early Pink Floyd sounds like early Eloy to me.
Yeah.
So pretty interesting how they evolved. And it reminds me of Rush because Rush's first couple of records had a very kind of typical rock sound. And then they started to expand some more, did some more conceptual stuff and experimented more with their music and then expanded into keyboards and all that kind of stuff. Eloy reminds me a lot of that. And I haven't like totally delved into their entire discography, but I've heard bits and pieces from, you know, different eras. And pretty interesting.
Yeah. And it's very clearly rock music, which I also think is quite different. Or slightly different offering from like the stereotypical kraut rock scene, which is they brought a style that was pretty unique for German bands at the time, because they being I guess one of the first symphonic sounding bands that utilized more than just synths. So somebody like Tangerine Dream, right, who went all synth for the most part. Eloy still uses bass and guitars and drums on top of the elaborate synth soundscapes and the invocations that the electronic instrument can offer. And so I really appreciate that. Because it certainly has the inclusions of the rock elements with the combination of the super spacey atmospheres and the, you know, all of that kind of stuff that we both enjoy and is very common towards the UK. Prog stuff going on.
Well, I'll tell you, just as far as like the synth sounds and everything too, there was a good bit of this record, Ocean, that reminded me a lot of the episode we did on Camel with Moon Madness. Like some of the key sounds in there, I was like, whoa, it's super reminiscent of that. And just kind of has a similar type of feel. So,
No, most definitely.
Very much reminded me of that.
Yeah. So they're not necessarily considered krautrock, but if you'd like to hear more information on krautrock, like Drew said, we go into a deeper history on episode 13 way back in the day. We listened to Future Days by Can, so you guys can go check that out if you'd like to. This album's lineup, and I say this album because Eloy had several lineups, is Frank Borneman on electric and acoustic guitars, lead vocals, and he's also credited as the producer of the record. I'm gonna try and do these names here. Klaus Peter Matzoil. I'm gonna go with that. Bass guitar and backing vocals. Detlev Schmitzen. Go with that. Synthesizers and keyboards. He also has a couple of solo albums, by the way, too. I went and checked out his kind of his credits on AllMusic, and he's got a lot of solo albums that he's been a part of, like recent stuff that he's done. So, and then the last one is Jürgen Rosenthal, who plays drums. Also is credited as flute, and also wrote the lyrics, which I find to be a little interesting as well. Yeah, the drummer wrote the lyrics for this, so we kind of have another kind of Rush thing going on.
It's really interesting, because what I've researched about this, a lot of it has been like, here's what Borneman, right, the kind of front man, vocalist, and guitarist, here's what he has to say about the concept. Uh-huh. I haven't heard much. That's interesting. I did not know that.
And what I found out, too, is, and I know we're kind of jumping ahead here, but I know what I found out with, in terms of the history and the lineup, a lot of it was because of the control like Bornemann had, like Bornemann had like this. Yeah, I think that's exactly why he left the band after the previous record, Silent or previous the next record. I think Silent Cries or something like that, and Mighty Echoes. And I think that's the reason why he left, is because there was this tension that was going on between. Actually, I have that written down. I'll go into that in just a second. I have all that written down. I'll go into that. Fun fact though, about Jürgen Rosenthal, he was a member of the Scorpions in 1974.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he left Scorpions and then went to do his military obligations. And then after he completed those, joined the band.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think
that's
there's...
That's a wild ride.
Yeah, I that might add some context in a minute once we get into some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to read some of their history before you go into some of the reviews that people said about this?
That'd
you want
be
me
great.
To go okay. I know we're gonna. We usually go to the reviews just to hear what some people think about it. But I'll go.
This is good context.
Yeah. Here's just the history of Ocean, because I think a lot of people, including myself, coming into this episode, was not very familiar with Eloy, not very familiar with their music, and so I wanted to do just a brief history of this album as well as some of the band to give people some context as well as just some information, since this might be a new band for some people. So, of course, I said there was a lot of musicians, a lot of lineups that were a part of Eloy. And this one is definitely the one that was the most successful. So Frank joined forces with guitarist Detlev. And then Detlev switched to keyboards for Eloy. So he was a guitar player that switched to keys. And then Klaus Peter, Matt Zoyl, and Jürgen Rosenthal became the new rhythm section, being the bassist and the drummer. The music now became even more orchestral and structurally diverse and atmospheric because of the addition of a keyboard player. So prior to Dawn, I think was their previous record, their first record, like you were talking about, they did not have a keyboard player. So I think that was one of the things that really kind of like shifted into their sound.
Exactly. Yeah, like I was saying, you don't really hear any sort of synthesized sound on their first record.
Right. And so which kind of brings that proggy element. I mean, it's definitely
synthesizer.
Which is a huge element. Especially on this record, but also in prog rock in general. It's 70s prog rock, let's say that.
Mm-hmm.
So now we got a little bit more structurally diverse and atmospheric. And then Jürgen Rosenthal wrote the lyrics. They were heavily mystical and reinforced the mood of the music. And so during rehearsals, the new quartet now wrote the music for the new album, Dawn. So this is the previous record. And the subsequent recording sessions in Cologne, a string orchestra added orchestral elements. So this is the first time that they wrote with a string with an orchestra, was on Dawn. And then the album hit the stores in 1976, at once becoming Eloy's greatest success so far. So they just hit big in 1976. They did two tours. They gained a pretty decent following and fan base in their own country. And now the ground was set up and clear for them to record Ocean in 1977, which remains... This is kind of the biggest thing and the biggest statement about this record. This is Eloy's best-selling album till today. So that's one of the biggest things, is that this is the best-selling album of Eloy today. So if you haven't heard Eloy before, this may be a great album to start with. It probably was for us too. And it brought the band's breakthrough, put them at the top of the progressive rock movement at the time. The opening song, Poseidon's Creation, was even used in a soundtrack for a TV production, and the painting got numerous awards for their album cover, which we'll come to that later. Ocean now became a cult album with continuous sales, and this is the second biggest fact probably that I have, is that it eventually turned out to be the best-selling progressive rock album by a German band to date, period.
Oh, wow.
So best-selling progressive rock album by a German band, and I think it also outsold bands like Pink Floyd and Genesis in Germany.
Yes. I had read that in Germany, this was more popular than a lot of the really already popular acts in the UK, based in the UK.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which was pretty significant for the time.
Oh, yeah.
Because like we were saying earlier, original German music recording just wasn't as popular as stuff that you could get from neighboring Western European countries.
Exactly.
Right? And especially, the UK, with a lot of just crazy, insane, awesome music coming out of there at that time during the 70s.
Yep.
I did not know that. It also might be interesting to know, I think this is called the Golden Years, or the Golden Trilogy of Eloy Records. I'm blanking on the exact name or term that they applied to it, but if you look it up, a lot of people consider that these three records, right, this is the second, this is the middle child, the middle child of the all three, but there was Dawn, right, which you just talked about, and then there was Ocean, this record, and then the last one, Silent Cries and Mighty Echoes.
Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting album cover design too, and color scheme that they used, because they had the yellow and blue records, right? So Dawn has a yellow one. Ocean has a very blue looking color scheme to it. And the last one, Silent Cries and Mighty Echoes, is green, which combination of yellow and blue makes green.
Right.
So I thought that was really cool, actually.
Interesting.
Anyways, we'll... Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll jump in. We'll jump into more. We'll get into all that. 1995, it was awarded gold by EMI, 25 years after its release. So sales figures in Germany alone were at 250,000 in Germany. So Eloy were high in the German charts in 1977. And like I said, they were outperforming British colleagues like Genesis and Pink Floyd. They were outperforming them in the country. And so subsequent tour, elaborately staged. They had a laser show that was going with it. Audiences were growing. Live shows was triumphant. Recordings of this was released in 1978, just a year after, on a double live album, or a double album, double live album called Live. Super original, right? Yeah. So fans were enthusiastic, although the reviews in many parts of the German media, especially in the relevant music magazines, were alarmingly negative. Sometimes even like aggressively denigrating and almost hostile. Like never before had any band in Germany inspire such strongly divided opinions between the audience and the music press as Eloy did after Ocean. And the musicians retired to the French Atlantic coast to write new songs. This is where all the strong tensions started developing between the artists, right? Jürgen and Frank, now they couldn't find any common ground concerning the lyrics. Jürgen had been writing all the band's lyrics since Dawn, according to their website. But Frank now thought that his bandmates' scenarios were too destructive in tone and difficult to adapt to melodies due to their phonetic quality.
I can totally see that.
I can totally understand that, which is I'm
listening to this record. Yeah.
But so shortly after, like you said, Silent Cries, Mighty Echoes was recorded in Cologne, once again, under heavy time pressure. Musically, the band managed to implement their sound, but the conflicts among the musicians did not cease. One point of issue was building of a studio for the band in Hanover. For the last few concerts of the tour in France, the band took on a second guitar player, something which had not been done since Power and the Passion, which was prior. And it was Hans Arkona, who actually ended up being a part of Eloy's 80s records. So he appears on a lot of those albums. Frank wanted him to stay as a permanent member of the band to expand the musical and instrumental range that they could cover. But unfortunately, Hans only saw the end to this very successful era of the band because Detlev and Jürgen left Eloy shortly after. They had a quick stint of success for the band, but it doesn't mean that they actually quit writing albums too. So if you're not familiar, they have 19 studio albums.
Yeah.
And a soundtrack. Like their most recent album was released in 2019. So I mean, they're still doing stuff. And so Bornemann's still going strong, writing new music. Unfortunately, I'm not well versed in the material, as this is my first Eloy record. I think this is also yours as well.
Yeah.
And so we can't speak really to the other records that they've released, if it's worth a listen or not. But according to what I've read with interviews of Frank, it's interesting. In an interview that I read with him, he considers their first record to be krautrock. But their second album, Inside, they picked up a new keyboard player, and the mixture of the rock and the pulsating rhythms and atmospheres is what made Eloy. But he considers the first album to be krautrock.
From what I heard, and I heard a fair chunk of their first record. I'm not sure if I finished the entire thing end to end.
I didn't get through it all.
But yeah, it seemed more
just straight rock.
It seemed more just straight rock.
Yeah, it was just straight rock music. I don't know. Yeah,
like early Led Zeppelin, early The Who. Like, it reminded me of that kind of stuff.
Yep. Yep. So, but what did the reviews have to say about this? I know you had a few of them.
Yeah, I didn't have any from the time period. Prague Archives gives it an aggregate score of 4.2 out of 5, and that's from a little over 1,100 ratings. People, 47% gave it a perfect score, which is close to half. 35% gave it a 4 out of 5, which is still excellent.
Yeah.
So 82% of people are, you know, regard this album pretty highly. And like you were saying, it is Eloy's most successful album. And, you know, someone on Sputnik Music said that this is like the band at their apex.
Yeah.
For sure. This is something I wanted to kind of touch on because you were talking about that they're still going strong and everything. Mm. And this was just something to note about the band. Someone on Prague Archives said something that I totally agree with. The user said, one of the factors I find appealing about this band is that in the span of 3 decades, they managed to present a style of music which was compatible with each era. So listening to their albums from different periods gives us a window into the progressive music of various time periods. And I totally agree with this because I also listen to some stuff from I listened to an album called Destination by them.
Okay.
This is '92, I believe. And it kind of had like kind of a neo-prog sound, right? When that was starting to take off, it had a newer sound to it, different instruments being incorporated, and it reminds me again of Rush a little bit, because we talked about on one of our Rush episodes, we did 2112 and Moving Pictures, on one of those we had mentioned that, like, it was probably 2112 when we were first starting out, that was our first episode, and we were geeking out about Rush, and Destin, you had mentioned, you know, if you don't like their 70s stuff, don't give up on them, because their 80s stuff and 90s stuff sounds very different from each other. You know,
yeah.
They really progressed as a progressive rock band and experimented with a lot of different sounds while still retaining their, you know, inherent character.
Sure.
You can tell is like, that's still Rush. I think Eloy does the same thing, and I really do admire that about them, is that they changed enough to really kind of progress and not stay stagnant and reflect the time periods they were in. But it still was like, but that's still the same vocalist, I can tell. And it still feels like Eloy. So,
yeah,
I do have to admire them about that. Other reviews I've seen either attack or defend the vocals of Frank Borneman.
Mm.
So that seems a pretty big point of contention. You know, just peppering in my own 2 cents here. I'm not a huge fan of them, but they're not so distracting that they take me out of the music like other albums I know. Pawn Hearts. others have criticized them
for
being a Pink Floyd ripoff, especially with an album like this. They have a lot of similar groovy jams like Pink Floyd. They've got these spacey synthesizers, these broad open guitar chords, these smooth, soulful guitar solos. Both of them, both Pink Floyd and Eloy, especially with this record, they're very psychedelic and very cosmic.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard people refer to Pink Floyd as psychedelic or cosmic rock.
Space rock, all that.
Space rock. Yeah, I think that Eloy definitely falls in that category as well. Honestly, I think that the drums in this are a bit more involved than Pink Floyd.
Yes.
They seem to be a little bit more complicated, you know, and add just a little bit more
variety,
flavor.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit more attention to the drums. Like, you can definitely tell their existence because there's some really interesting, fun fills and rolls.
Yep. I also hear traces of stuff like Alan Parsons in this too.
I can see that.
I was thinking, I was hearing specifically in Atlantis Agony, the last track. Mm-hmm. This album's only 4 songs. I think it still spans like 44 minutes, but that last song, it reminds me of Tales of Mystery and Imagination. It actually reminds me of some of like Fall of the House of Usher. Kind of reminded me a little bit of those area or some of that stuff. I heard some traces of Pink Floyd and Alan Parsons and people say that they heard a lot of Neil Peart and the drums. And we were discussing this prior about I think it was just kind of the sound of the drums with like the rotos right. that he's using.
The tonal and, shaping of them is pretty similar to stuff like 2112, which came out just a year before this.
Yeah. And who knows if they, I don't know if they have, if they included them as an influence. I don't know. Maybe he did. Maybe he could include him as an influence for this, but I'm not sure. But one of the biggest things I think about this album that is kind of the meat of this album is, yes, all the music and stuff like that that's going on with it. Something that's bigger, though, is really the concept of this record, because this is most definitely a concept album, and the concept is quite interesting, so to speak. We were trying to do a little bit of research on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty difficult, at least I found, going through and reading some of this stuff, because it's based in Greek mythology, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, though, but I think it's also I think it's talking about, what did I write down here? It was like combining the tale of Poseidon and the myth of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of what I found. But I know that you have some stuff that was written on this as well. I'll chime in if I have anything to say here.
Well, you can tell that these guys, like a lot of prog rockers and prog rock fans, you can tell that they're uber nerds. You see what I did there?
Yeah.
See what I did there with the uber?
It's pretty good.
Because they're German?
They're German, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty
Uba.
Good.
Uba.
Yeah.
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 Oh! Whew! Yeah. It's definitely based around the myth of Atlantis. And like you said, it's told in four fairly lengthy tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Super proggy thing to do, with the shortest track on here to be like over 8 minutes.
Yeah. Right.
I'll also give just a precursor to this. This is another reviewer kind of gave a very brief synopsis of it. The allegorical concept of ocean is a cautionary tale based on the ancient myth of Atlantis, a heaven on earth continent containing a race of people who became so corrupt that they had to be destroyed by the gods before they terminally polluted the earth. Bornemann has said they chose the subject of Atlantis to point out the wrong direction society is taking, that our development into such a wrong direction can only result in a catastrophe. But provides no answers to the conundrum. The 1998 follow-up Ocean 2 was an attempt at redress. So I think that the Ocean 2 is really interesting. And unfortunately, I did not do very much research on Ocean 2. I should have, because I would be really interested to see kind of how they followed up this record, which was their most successful and was pretty ambitious conceptually.
Yeah, it's also pretty ambitious to follow up your most successful album
by calling it
Ocean 2. Yeah.
This is, yeah.
Man.
But just some context for people who may not know the story of Atlantis. Also, I'm going to throw shade at myself. I'm going to drag myself here. I did way too much research into the creation story on Greek mythology and not enough time into like just
the end of the album
story of Atlantis, for instance. So if you want to know about Uranus and Gaia and the creation of the Titans and the Titanomachy,
there you go.
Let me know. I'll share what I've
bonus
what I've
episode. Learned. Become a patron.
Bonus episode. What an excellent plug, Destin.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the story of Atlantis is most popularly known to be told by Plato, philosopher, Greek philosopher, told in around 360 BC. So the myth is basically there was this utopian civilization on this island called Atlantis, inhabited by a powerful race of humans that were like half god, half human.
Yeah.
Because they were created by Poseidon, because Poseidon mated with a woman named, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, Plato? That's how they pronounce it in their lyrics. They actually reference specifically the woman, and they pronounce it Plato. Bornemann does.
Okay.
I don't know. I've heard someone say Cleto. I've heard... I read it as Clito. I don't know.
I don't know.
I have no idea. anyway, so he mates with this mortal woman, so they create like half god, half... these like demigods, basically.
Yeah.
And they live in splendor on this island, which is a veritable paradise. It has everything they could possibly want. It has, you know, a hot stream and a cold stream, right? Cold stream for drinking, hot stream for either, you know, bathing or washing and all this kind of stuff. You know, and they were perfect physical specimen and all that kind of stuff. Everything was great. Well, as they continue to mate and generations continue,
yeah,
the God aspect of them becomes more diluted because they're just mating with each other, not mating with gods over and over again.
Right.
So they become more human. Human.
Yeah, it's diluted.
And so human nature gets involved, and that means pride and, you know, the idea of hubris, you know, the overarching theme of this story. You know, they get kind of overly ambitious, and they start to be nasty towards each other, and they start showing the ugly side of human nature, and they start to conquer neighboring civilizations out in the Mediterranean and all of that.
Hmm.
They get drunk with power and ambition, and they eventually turn into kind of this evil race, right,
yeah,
of people. And Zeus, the figurehead of the gods,
yep,
the god of the gods, is noticing this, and he talks to his brother Poseidon, who created them, and he's like, bro, your kids...
You're, okay, where's this going? Bro. Your kids...
I'm sorry. I didn't expect that to come out that way.
That was pretty incredible. Bro, your kids?
I'm sorry. I'm making myself laugh too hard. That's so dumb. Anyways, yeah, he says,
he says, Poseidon, your kids are having this big problem here. They're pretty much evil. They're not, like, representative of the gods, and, like, they're kind of, like, they're not, but they kind of are at the same time because you created them. That's not cool. And they're doing bad things. You need to fix this.
And Poseidon is,
I don't know whether, I don't know whether it was Zeus or Poseidon who made the decision, but the executor was Poseidon because he's, anyways,
uh-huh,
he creates this huge earthquake and the city falls into the sea. And that's where you get the lost legend and myth of Atlantis, you know, crumbling into the sea and all of that. Because, by the way, people just associate Poseidon with the ocean and the sea most of the time. At least that's what I think of. He's also the god of earthquakes. And also, fun fact, the god of horses. There's a whole story there. No, there's a whole story there, which I could go to in greater detail later on.
What?
Yes, like
not another element or a catastrophe?
No, no, no. The god of horses.
Just horses.
Well, they were a very useful resource, right?
Right, right, right.
A lot
right.
of ancient civilizations, especially for transportation and
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, yeah,
it is kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
Like, why you lump that in with, like, earthquake and sea and I don't know.
I don't know. Apparently horses are at that caliber.
Anyways, so their hubris destroyed them because they became evil and selfish and blah, blah, blah. And so this was very, very clearly an allegory of how human nature, you know, can be damaging and it can lead to its own destruction. And the best way to live is to simply, you know, appreciate the things that you already have rather than seeking out new things to conquer or enforce your will upon. So, I think for a long time, and some people still out there today, no kidding, conspiracy theorists think that Atlantis was an actual place. Some people
right.
think this. I think it's pretty apparent that Plato was like, this is just a story that I made up.
Right.
Like, you know, but I think some people back in the day maybe wanted to believe it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And down through generations, that kind of belief and wonder just carried on. So there's some people still speculate that it's actually out there.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, I guess kind of in their, you know, the plausible deniability of it not existing is that, well, a huge chunk of the ocean has not been explored. I think it's like over 80 or 90% of the ocean is still unexplored. So it could be out there. Anyways, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But this was what Bornemann was trying to express with this. And also, someone I had read online said that this is a parallel Bornemann was trying to make, not just between like society and everything, but also kind of touching back on your point with how they came up with the band name, kind of a similar type of theme, that just like, you know, Eloy, they were trying to really experiment and become their own thing. You know, the individuals in Atlantis were finding their humanity or their individualism, their independence from godhood, whether they meant to or not.
Sure.
But they were coming into their own individual nature. So too were bands trying to find their individualism by experimenting and creating music that was different and very explorative. And so
interesting.
That was an interesting take had on that. Yeah. I was like, I see that.
Yeah, that could be a tie into that for sure.
So,
which makes sense.
Anyways.
Yeah. So, I found something that somebody else said online that they thought that the myth of Atlantis, how man lost paradise on Earth and Atlantis was because of his violent nature, they were saying that was a metaphor for nuclear menace that was alive in 1977 in Germany. They thought that the entire tale of Poseidon and the myth of Atlantis was completely a metaphor for the cultural historical background that was happening at the time
during
in Germany during the Cold War. Exactly. And
right.
So I didn't have... Yeah, they just think that they were using Atlantis completely as a metaphor. So I'll kind of like... You know, I'm not too familiar with the Cold War. I'm not a massive history buff, so I had to go and research this. So I'm just going to say it, assuming that no one else knows kind of the main point of what the Cold War was or anything. But I'm taking this completely directly just from online as a description. So I'm quoting here from online saying that the Cold War was an ideological war between two world superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, beginning after World War II. So after the war, Germany was left defeated. Britain and France were left drained and exhausted. United States, Soviet Union, though also drained, held considerable power. Both soon rose to superpower status. So the two became rivals through these, quote, conflicting ideologies and mutual distrust. Constantly competed for power. So the Soviet Union wanted to spread communism in Eastern Europe and create this buffer zone of friendly governments as defense against Germany. And so in 1946, with the Eastern European with Eastern Europe under Soviet control and influence, Europe was now divided into the West, which is the Western democracies in the United States, the West Bloc, rather, I think is what they call it, and then the East Bloc. The Soviet Union and the Soviet occupied territory. So there was this kind of a iron curtain that separated Europe. So during the Cold War, Germany, right? We're talking about a German band here. They became the center for all of those tensions between the democracy and the communism because the location of Germany acted as a gateway between the East and the West Europe. So it made it this ideal place for these political struggles to occur, which I found to be quite interesting because I couldn't deny the fact that could be used. And of course, I don't know what they were going through. I think that these guys, they were born in, I think they were born in the 40s, like 45, 46. I know they're like in their 70s today. I don't know. My math is not.
Yeah, I mean, that tracks.
Is that track right? Okay. So they were born in the 40s, which is kind of during that World War II time. So... Another thing that I found as well is that all of these guys in the band, including like somebody like Frank, and they were born all over. I think Frank was born in Hanover, but all of the other guys were born in like different parts of Germany, all over the place. Mm-hmm. But they recorded the album in Cologne, and I don't know exactly why. I don't know if that was by necessity of what was happening culturally at the time, or not culturally, but socially and politically at the time. Or if they just wanted to go to Cologne. But I found it quite interesting to be that they recorded this album in 1976, 1977, the top of 1977. And during World War II, so just 20 years prior to this, Cologne was bombed 262 times. Mm. 262 times. 20,000 people died due to all of these aerial bombardments. So, and I think there was actually like the Cologne bombings is a thing. Like the Cologne bombings of World War II is a thing. In the 50s, they're like wiped out. This the whole thing is completely wiped out. And I think, but in the 40s and in the early 50s, by 1959, what I found in research to this is that is when the city sort of reached the pre-war numbers. and they were growing steadily all throughout into the 70s, including into the time that this album was recorded. So I didn't know if there was this sense of like rebuild that was happening there, or new creation that was happening in Cologne.
Sure, I can see that. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Due to the status of the city at the time and going to record this record. And there's got to be a lot of rebuilding happening. A lot of
absolutely
restructuring.
And I can see that as a parallel to the story of Atlantis.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't have a ton of stuff in terms of like diving deep into the lyrics and how they relate to this. But those are just some of the things that I found. And I found that quote to be quite interesting, how they were very very convinced that this whole thing was just a metaphor for the nuclear menace that was happening in 1977 in Germany. So just a fun fact, another way of looking at the lyrics outside of the mystical mythological aspect of it.
Right, bringing it back down to earth.
It could be a combination of the two. It could be neither. I don't know. But I thought it'd be worth mentioning.
No, absolutely.
So
I think it's definitely worth interesting. That's a really, really, really interesting kind of idea to think about. I mean, we don't think about a lot of the times historically and culturally and socially what's going on when we're like reviewing these records.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
For sure.
Like with Rush, it's like, this is just a really awesome, cool album.
Yep.
Right? Because we don't really think, okay, why did Rush make this? Was there a reason, you know, what was going on in Canada during that time or whatever? And maybe a lot of times there wasn't, right?
Sure.
Maybe some of the bands we listened to didn't go through something that was, you know, as traumatic as, you know, trying to rebuild after, you know, not only rebuild after World War II, but also still living in the midst of nuclear threat all the time. And, you know, the whole world was.
Right.
Because, you know, that could have been World War III.
Yep.
Right.
That was the Cold War. You know, that entire
That was the Cold War, that threat. But, you know, something like you were saying, something like Germany, where they are basically at the epicenter of, you know, they are the division line.
Yep.
Right? It's East and West Germany. That's crazy to think about. And plays a factor, I'm sure, into why, you know, into some of the mentality of the people there, including, you know, the musicians of this band.
Yep.
Frank Borneman and the lyricist as well.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Again, it doesn't really change my opinion about the record, though. Like, it doesn't... I don't know. I always come back to what is musically happening, because I think we mentioned this before, is that the vocals did not grab me in a way. I know that was, like, one of the things that you found. It's not bad. It's not bad at all. I just think... the way that they were delivering this was in a very conceptual way. There was a lot of like some spoken word sections. There's a lot of effects that were being put on, and some of that sing talking stuff going on. And quite frankly, that's hilarious. That was not pun intended, actually. Quite frankly, I just don't think his voice is charismatic enough to be able to do that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I didn't feel that from him. And I know some people complain about the German accent. That didn't bother me. I actually kind of like it in a way.
Yeah, it didn't bother me, and it wasn't like so thick that I couldn't like understand what you're saying. No, like, yeah, that didn't bother me either.
No,
because it was very clear what they were saying.
Yeah, and honestly, and even just to go back even prior to listening to this record, German bands usually have a checkered history for me, so. Stuff like Tangerine Dream and Can and Sylvan or Nectar, RPWL, and now Eloy. I didn't have high hopes for this record. I didn't have high hopes for this to strike me personally. Although I did enjoy it musically. I did enjoy a lot of the sections. I thought some of it, like the very beginning of, I think, Incarnation of Logos, the second track, like the first 3 minutes of that, I was like, get me out of here. This is just I was like,
it's just too spacey.
It was just too nothingness, I guess. Yeah, like it was there. I'm like, let's go somewhere. Let's just, you know, this is a rock record. I don't know, but the bass is certainly the highlight for me, though. There were a lot of like the grooviness.
Oh man,
the bass
is excellent.
The bass is excellent
on this record. It does groove.
It grooves hard, and
the tone is so strong, and yeah, the melodies are so iconic and groovy, and they just lock in so well.
Yeah, and some of the synth sounds too. Some of the synth solos, and like Poseidon's Creation, and some of the other, and even Atlantis Agony, there was a lot of like really cool synth lines, catchy stuff that was going on, and so yeah. But I think this is overall a great band to introduce yourself to something that was different out of Germany in the 70s that wasn't technically considered krautrock in the traditional sense of the word, but more along the lines of like global concept of like European and UK and even like American symphonic prog, or even like symphonic idealism.
Yeah, no, like it's a very unique experience.
Yeah,
for sure.
And how they created their music too. I think they stuck with many of the German traditions as we spoke of with some of the krautrock and singing in English as well, but having the accent very clearly German, which I found that to be somewhat of a. Some of a charismatic element, but still, his voice to me just didn't strike me in a way that didn't bring me into the story, I suppose.
Well, and to go back to what you were saying about his kind of contentious relationship with the lyricist, and forgive me, it's Jürgen Rosenthal.
I think that's right. Yeah,
Jürgen Rosenthal. I kind of understand that, like from a storytelling perspective, this is probably a good thing. The fact that they're so direct with a narrative this dense, it's probably best that the lyrics weren't very ambiguous or interpretive or anything like that. It makes sense to not leave much to the interpretation when you're just trying to tell about this story of Atlantis and everything, and introducing, you know, these characters like Poseidon and Clayto and all that stuff. But like, it's better than, like, I don't know, I love Genesis to death, but The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, what the heck is he saying?
What is he talking about? Right.
What is... Right. I mean, there's a concept here, but, like, you really have to do homework, like, intense homework to figure out what he's talking about. And even then, it's interpretive. There's no, like, real clear-cut answer.
Uh-huh.
But none of these lyrics on Ocean really resonate with me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other side to that is they're not very artistic. They're not very profound, I don't think. The overall story might be... But they do a good job of telling the story, but there aren't any parts that are particularly like quotable.
No, I get that.
Not to me, at least.
And so, personal too, because this is This whole album kind of is in space. This whole album is kind of above the head.
It's set in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. There's no real personality.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
kind of going on there. And crud. There are parts where there's like an omniscient narrator. They're just telling you what's happening.
I cannot do that. That
and, like, there's
thing.
A part where he's just talking, like, it's like theater. Uh-huh. It's like going on a stage play, and like, okay, this is the guy's soliloquy,
uh-huh.
right? Or a big monologue of the exposition, or maybe not the exposition, but just like what's happening now at the very end.
Yeah,
of the story, like the last song.
Exactly. The entire like minute of that, or first 30 seconds of that entire thing, is basically just like a couple of just spoken word, essentially.
I don't know. As a theater geek, it doesn't bother me that much because it didn't go on too long. It was like, oh, this is a cool like monologue here, but
yeah,
it was a bit empty. It was a bit empty.
And the thing that I'm going to come back to as well, and I'm going to kind of like ground it with that, is just the delivery of it wasn't charismatic. It wasn't in a way that was. It was more than it. I don't know. It said like the personality was stripped away from the content, and the content was the only thing that was left there, and the content was just sort of empty. And so as I'm listening to it, the only thing I'm really being grappled by is the content, because the voice isn't grabbing me. And a lot of the time, I think, too, there was wasn't a whole lot of rhythm in the vocals. Like a lot of the time, some of the vocals were like singing over the bar line. Now, if you have a charismatic voice like Dave Matthews, you can do that. But this guy doesn't. It didn't feel on. I don't know. It didn't grab me. So that's that. Yeah. That's all I'll say about the vocals. Musically, though, I like it. I really did enjoy it. Since the bass, definitely the bass. The bass guitar is just driving the whole thing home. Yeah. It sounds great.
I liked some of the drumming in there too. Those toms are really fun. Yeah. Those roto toms are really fun.
Yeah. There's definitely nothing to bat an eye at.
Cool rhythms there. The bass and the drums lock in really well together.
Which is probably some of that krautrock feel too, sort of that that motoric kind of thing.
Yes.
That was very prominent in the krautrock music. So now we wanted to go into the album cover. We have a nice little segment that we like to call Illustrations and Impressions. We won't spend too much time on this, just talking about some of the album cover. But this is our interpretation of the album cover. We just talk a little bit about maybe some of the concepts or the themes that we've been previously discussing and how they relate to the album cover and the concept art and all of that. So this is Illustrations and Impressions. I can't get over that. That's just the best part of that entire thing. So this album, the album cover is quite in the state of the mythological stuff that's going on. So when we were talking about some of the concept and how it relates, it really is more relative to the mythological stuff, not the historical political stuff that's going on. And so with that being said, I kind of want to focus more on that part of it being the sort of the mythological thing. And I do want to mention this when it comes to the album cover is that you were mentioning that, and I didn't know this, you're mentioning that Poseidon was the god of water and horses and then
earthquakes,
right? And I found that to be really interesting because of the head of, I'm going to guess that this is Poseidon being the cracked sort of, thing that's
kind of a dissolving,
And that's the other question that I had too that was coming from this, is that is he dissolving into the space, into that galaxy, or is the galaxy dissolving into Poseidon,
dissolving into him and like forming him?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's my question. I'd like to pose
a great question. I see it as just from the direction and like, yeah, from the direction that the planet seems to be spinning.
Yes, which is in counterclockwise. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes. My guess, and the way that it's kind of, you know, the circular motion, those little wisps, right? And the direction of
the particles coming off of him.
My guess is that he is dissolving into the essence of the planet.
Getting sucked
and
into
it. So my whole deal is like, maybe he is going into the earth. Like his essence is coming into the earth. And maybe that's because like part of him is, you know, creating this new race of Atlanteans. Mm. Right. So
yeah,
maybe that's part of it. You know, it's also interesting that he is not whole. If this is Poseidon,
sure, because we don't know. That's the thing.
Yeah, we don't. Like, I mean, we're guessing because it's like it's a perfect, you know, physical form,
but,
right?
But,
which all of the gods are always drawn that way because they're gods. They have the perfect physical form, right? So this, I'm guessing that this is Poseidon because it seems like it's a god, and especially with like the clothing too. It's just like this, like, you know.
It looks very
white
Greek
robe,
Greek, yeah,
kind of draped over him, and it seems like it's a god, and the only god we hear mentioned in this record is really Poseidon. So I'm guessing that's what it is. If it is, why is what he's holding not his very famous trident, which was forged for him in the Titanomachy against the war between the Titans.
Dude, that's
gods,
a good
blah,
question.
Blah, blah. Why isn't he holding that? He's holding a scepter that seems to be adorned with a fractured skull. And I'm wondering, maybe that shows his...
The brokenness of humanity there?
The brokenness of humanity?
Like the...
But why is Poseidon holding that? Another reason is maybe it's just Poseidon's destructive nature. If they're really going into the whole Greek thing, because lots of the gods were very destructive, but yeah. Poseidon was pretty hot-tempered. Poseidon was a guy you didn't want to piss off, and it was easy to piss him off. So
yeah.
he was very hot-tempered and impulsive, I think. But yeah, so why is he holding that?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
Yeah, that's really
And that's what makes it a little bit more difficult.
Yep.
To define as, yep. Is this Poseidon? Because we always see Poseidon with his trident.
Right.
And that's an iconic thing.
That's how you know it's Poseidon.
He's always holding. Exactly.
That's how you know it's Poseidon.
And so with this, it's not. So you're like, I'm not entirely sure, but we think it is. We think it is.
Yeah. Even then, though, you know, we were talking about how it's kind of getting sucked into the galaxy there. And yes. How, like, the top of it is sort of cracked and he's headless there. But if you take a look at the bottom where the robe is and all mm-hmm. of that, it's also very clearly, that doesn't look like, that looks very clearly like cracks, like an earthquake. It doesn't,
yeah.
That does not look to me like wrinkles of a robe, you know? So if he's, why yeah. is it that he is.
Maybe it's supposed to just, you know, obviously pretty transparently reflect the whole fact that he's the god of earthquakes.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that could be a direct translation, I suppose. You're right.
Right.
I haven't looked anything of the. I do have the guy's name, and I will butcher it. So, but I will give it a shot. The guy who painted this, Wojtek Zsigmond.
I don't.
That's probably horrible, and I apologize to any Germans or yeah, any Germans
or
listening
German
to
speaking.
This. German speaking. I do apologize.
Yeah.
But
people listening, yeah.
But yeah. I mean, but like I said before, this got numerous awards. This album cover did.
It's very pretty.
It is.
I like it.
Quite nice. And I do like the color.
Really, well, yeah. And I was like looking into that too, because it just kind of reflects the mood of the record. Like in general, this is not like super high octane, high energy.
No, yeah. It's very,
metal
it's very
or
blue.
Super hard rock. It's very, well, it's funny you say that. It's very blue.
Very blue. Yeah.
Right.
Because yeah,
in color psychology, blue is associated typically with calmness and serenity.
Like what is green? If blue is serenity, what is green? Because I'm not. Are we gonna have to Google that real quick? Because I really kind of want to know.
I don't know.
Because
Let's
we were talking previously about the whole album thing being the first Dawn being red, this one being or did you say red? This one being blue, mm-hmm. and then the Silent Cries
being
and Mighty
yellow.
Echoes.
Right. So the previous one was yellow.
Oh, yellow,
sorry,
not
that's,
red.
That's what
not
I meant.
Red. Yellow.
So Dawn is yellow.
Got it.
Ocean is blue. And Silent Cries and Mighty Echoes is green.
What is
right? the combination of the two?
I
want to
know. I want to know. What
I mean, it's pretty. I mean, clear. Like jealousy, right? Is one of them, right?
For jealousy, for what?
Someone they're so envious, they're green. You know what I mean?
Ah, okay.
Right. You've heard that expression yeah. or something along the lines of that.
Yeah.
Money, right?
Right.
So that could also be kind of greed, right?
Yep,
just like
right.
the jealousy thing.
Interesting.
Also, you know, physical illness. Right. If you're
yep.
sick, when you see a lot of cartoons when people are about
yep.
to puke,
they're
in those
green
cartoons, you'll see them turn their face turn green for a second.
Yep.
So
interesting.
But it's also, I mean, you know, color psychology, like green means go, means good.
Yep.
Right. A
yep.
lot of times people just say it means good.
Yeah.
Right. But with this, it seems to be to really reflect the blue. I love how you said that. Like your first thing, you were just like, yeah, I get like instantly. You were like, yeah, it's a very blue.
It's a very blue.
It sounds
album.
Very blue.
Yeah.
This album, like it sounds blue.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
Well, it sounds the.
It doesn't just
look I
guess, blue, it sounds blue.
And yeah. even outside of the color psychology of it being like the serene or anything of that nature, I was more thinking of the spacey element to it. Like the starry
yeah, for sure.
sky blue kind of like floating through space sort of deal.
Right. Well, and that there is a lot of unoccupied space. It's this grand,
yeah.
like we are in the midst of the universe
uh-huh.
here.
Yep.
Right.
A lot of dead space sometimes.
Maybe see, yeah, at the bottom, you maybe see like the clouds of a planet. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. Like an atmosphere.
It's a different shade
or something.
Of blue.
Yeah.
yeah. It looks like, yeah, it looks like more of like the sky blue as opposed to the darker blue that's above it, which is, you know, the space blue.
Yep.
That you typically see in a lot of representations of space.
Most definitely.
So yeah, I mean, I think the album cover does really do a good job of reflecting that sense of the sound of the record, the musical mood of the record, but it also adds some pretty interesting elements to the concept of it and yeah. everything. So I understand why it won some awards. There's some really, really cool stuff.
It's unique.
On this. That's a lot of, sure. again, a lot of unanswered questions as to, you know, what is that skull scepter? Why is he holding that?
Mm-hmm.
And there are a bunch of interpretations, but there's a lot to interpret with this, which I like. And you'll see, it looks like there are a variety of different planets. So there's the big
I do see those,
one
yeah.
with the rings, but not planets maybe, but moons.
Yeah.
Like, who knows, right? You know, orbiting around.
Yeah.
Like they're not stars. They're not stardust or whatever.
Yep.
They seem to be like moons or something kind of circling around it. So
yeah, most definitely. That's quite
interesting. They put that there too.
You know, I'm also a big fan of the, you know, the Cheers font that they got going on here for Eloy.
Yeah.
And I also find it interesting
kind of
too.
Cursive. Yeah.
I also find it too that they kept the blue for the next record. I thought that the blue Eloy was part of the overall color scheme, but they kept that for Silent Cries and Mighty Echoes. It's still that green album cover, but, and honestly, let me take a look at Dawn real quick. I'm going to make sure if I'm.
Well, Dawn is.
No,
yellow.
it's also gold now, but yeah. So they kept yeah. what the heck is that all about, dude? So they keep the, I'm looking way too far into this. I don't care.
Destin's upset.
I'm upset.
Eloy for Silent Cries and Mighty Echoes is not green.
Why is it not green? It doesn't fit.
It should be green.
Gosh.
Destin is not a
gosh! Shoot. Yeah, that's not real. But anyway. Yeah, I think that's everything that we have really to say about this record. Do you have anything else
yeah,
to say?
I think so. I enjoyed it because I love the nerdy stuff, and it made me go down a really big rabbit trail of just like the Greek gods and everything.
Uh-huh.
And it's always fun
yeah.
to kind of revisit. It's fun stories.
Yeah, it's interesting. This album is a kind of a synthesis of atmospheric electronic sounds with orchestral rock music patterns and some esoteric lyrics.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's prog for you. That's mm-hmm. that's some prog rock. How about that? So
yeah.
Anyway, this is fun. I'm glad that we got to listen to this record. Thank you for all. I also want to mention this before we close.
Hey, Destin, I think we should do this again sometime.
We should probably
do this.
Talk
about records.
We should talk about records
at some point.
And do some stuff on prog rock specifically.
Down.
Yeah, break down some stuff.
Yeah,
and we could talk about our thoughts and stuff about it. I think that was kind of interesting. Yeah. But before we close down here, I know that most people are going to be tuning off around this time. But if you could just please stick around for just a second, because I wanted to. Just say a brief thank you. This is episode 40. We've done 40 of these episodes. Now, I know you're thinking, like, you may be thinking that, like, oh, they just do this for themselves. Not really. I mean, we do. Like, we hate doing.
We're not doing it because we like it.
But we do this to a certain extent for ourselves, and we do enjoy it. But I think the majority of at least my satisfaction in doing this is actually hearing from other people and knowing that other people are listening to it and commenting and joining our Discord community and talking with us about it and sharing their thoughts about our thoughts and recommending and wanting us to do more records and wanting us to listen to other records and stuff like that. So I love that. I really enjoy listening to everybody's opinions, and I really enjoy listening to everybody's suggestions for, like, oh, you guys should do this record. Like, you guys should do this record. Like, this would be super cool if you guys covered this on the show. And so that's really awesome. It means a lot. And we're really excited for the next upcoming year. This is now, we're kind of in our third year of doing this, and with the release of Spotlight come in, and now we're going to be having some more newer bands join in, and we're going to be able to interview them and talk to new bands as well as some old prog rock legends, hopefully, on the show. And so I just wanted to say briefly a quick thank you for helping us get this far, because if we only had two people listening to this, or even 100 people listening to this, I'd be like, this is sort of, I'm like, all right, it's just kind of there. I enjoy it, but why am I releasing this online and all of this other stuff as well? So that's all I had to say. Did you have anything? Yeah. Did you have anything to add on to that? This wasn't really scripted here.
Well, no, it's all good. Yeah. Big thank you to everyone who, you know, takes the time to reach out to us, whether it's on our Discord. I know that's kind of what we're most active on, or I check emails more than I do the Discord. So there you go.
Yeah.
But however you reach out to us, it's nice. Crud, I've gotten even phone calls from people who are really, you know, really appreciate what we do and have suggestions for other things we check out. So
yeah,
I appreciate it too. I don't have much new stuff to offer other than my sincere appreciation and thanks as well.
Yeah, so absolutely. And so and we're looking to do more stuff with our Patreon, and it's supporting us on our Patreon is huge. Like that would mean a lot to us, because it helps us pay for a lot of the things that we have to keep up and running. Because it does cost us money to run this podcast and to run the show and the Discord and all of these other things that we that are included in the running of the show. So thank you to everybody who's listening, and thank you for listening to our podcast. These are our prog notes for Ocean by Eloy. So if you enjoyed this episode, if you learned something new from this episode, please share it with somebody and subscribe. Subscribe to us. You will never miss an upcoming episode. You can become, like I said, special Prognotes patron at patreon.com/prognotes. You can support the show. You can get extra benefits to the show if you'd like, or you could just throw a dollar our way and as a thank you. And so we would appreciate anything. You can join our Discord server, which is just, like I said, a chat community for all prog rock fans and fans of the show. A lot of people that listen to this show don't have a lot of people to talk about prog with. And I get it. We were there in high school. We were there. There's not a whole lot of people who we can talk to progressive rock about. That's the reason that we started the Discord server and the community. The whole community exists so you can connect with other prog rock fans and fans of the podcast, but specifically other prog rock fans, so we can talk about the albums that we like and suggest new albums to each other and learn and figure out more records and stuff like that. Because we all like doing the deep dives, but we all like discovering new stuff. And like we know, this stuff doesn't play on the radio very often. It's hard to find sometimes. Right. So you have to do a little bit of digging. And I'll promise you, there are people who have done the digging for you, including us. Mm-hmm. And so we can help you with that. So come join the Discord server. It's in the episode's description. And before we close, Drew, what is the next episode that we're checking out? What's the next album that we're checking out on the next episode?
Episode 41, we're going to be doing Aqualung by Jethro Tull.
We going back, dude. Well, actually, never mind. I guess we're kind of already back. Like, we're in the 70s. But
yeah, we're in the 70s.
The last time we covered a Jethro Tull record was back in episode, nine? When we did Thick as a Brick?
Thick as a Brick, yep.
So we figured that Jethro Tull needs a little bit more love. And so we're going to go check out Aqualung.
Some more attention, Jethro Tull.
Exactly. So don't forget, on the first of the month, the newest episode of Spotlight releases. So go check out Drogan and Chelsea, see what they got to offer you guys. And join us next time as we discover the past, present, and future of prog rock. We will see you on Discord. Thanks.
Bye-bye.